Accession number 6105, Reel 3.
Dr. Clapham, Reel 3. What were the general health problems at Kuching?
I think it's fair to say that because the camp area had been particularly carefully planned beforehand to be as much as we could make it malaria-free, that we didn't in fact get a great deal of malaria at all there. There might have been the odd individual who had malaria anyway and who brought it in with them. So I think really the main health problems were, in the very early days, vitamin deficiency owing to a rather restricted diet, which hadn't been largely cured by the time I got into the camp, because by that time people were growing their own vegetables and making their own sort of vitamin supplement. And the other main area of ill health would be, I think, dysentery of one sort or another, which seemed to be ever present. But the camp had for a long time got its hygiene very well organized. For example, there was always in the kitchen a large cauldron of boiling water, and everybody was able to dip their plates or mugs or spoons into this boiling water to sterilize them either before they got food on it or afterwards. So there would be no excuse at all for having a dirty plate or a plate which had been fly-blown in some way. And again, of course, people were very careful to scavenge around about so there were no places that would breed flies. And so I think it's fair to say those were the main things. Again, I think medically speaking, it's quite possible to say that some individuals had their lives prolonged even by these conditions, because they were people who, for example, were drinking too much before they came into the camp, when they were stopped instantly from alcohol of any sort or kind, whose life was probably prolonged in that way, and others perhaps whose restricted diet probably helped them from becoming too grossly fat, as they might have done otherwise, although probably by the end of the war they were very much thinner than they would prefer to have been. So those, I think, were the main health problems at the time. I don't think really there were any very serious problems of mental health. I think it's a curious attitude of the difference, shall we say, between what I would call the mentality of the continental and the mentality of the UK citizen, because at least one of the doctors there was an Austrian. And he said at one stage, "I cannot understand how you British can carry on with the Japanese behaving like this. We would long ago have gone raving mad."
What did he mean? Behaving like what?
Well, being philosophical, I think, under the situation and circumstances of the camp. Another very interesting thing, talking of the sort of psychology of it, was that there were some Ambonese soldiers, in other words, Dutch army soldiers from the island of Ambon, who were all very good Muslims. And the Japanese, in a fairly typical way, put them to looking after the pigs. As you know, pigs are absolutely an abhorrent and violent, disgusting animal to any Mohammedan. And we said to these Ambonese soldiers, "For goodness sake, if we had asked you to do this, you would have run amok." And they said, "We don't run amok." And we said, "Well, why don't you?" And they said, "We dare not." Which I think is a very interesting facet on amok, for one thing, which rather implies that there is a degree of responsibility in it, although many people used to think that going amok was entirely something out of the person's control. But these soldiers said, "We dare not do it," knowing that they would get beaten up, if not killed, by the Japs if they did such a thing.
Mm.
So is that the sort of question?
Talking about the psychological problems, what were the pressures and tensions at a psychological, emotional level?
I suppose the pressures and tensions of anybody who is being incarcerated against their will. As I say, I think the phlegmatic British approach was probably easier than what I could call the continental or even the American approach. And so really I don't think anybody suffered seriously at all in that way.
Amongst the British themselves, were there recognisably any kinds of people who were less able to stand up to the pressures of internment than others?
Yes, I think there were one or two individuals whose mentality or mental setup perhaps couldn't take it as well as others, and there was one particular individual who undoubtedly became quite unbalanced at one time, and this made him rather dangerous to us because we were at the time getting clandestine news through a clandestine radio. And he was the sort of person who, had he known about it, and he obviously did, would easily have mentioned it quite inadvertently to a Japanese guard in some way or another, which could have caused a great deal of trouble for everybody concerned. And so he was a source of considerable embarrassment to us. In fact, we didn't really know how to deal with him. Mm. And it was a problem which I don't think ever was solved in the end.
As a group, were there any particular kinds of things that bucked you up or got you down?
I don't think so. We would naturally become irritated if the Japanese introduced what we felt to be unnecessary restrictions, but there was usually a way around it. For instance, at one time they had a very unpleasant habit of removing electric light bulbs from the huts, which we liked to have very much in the evening, so playing bridge and so on. And it wasn't too difficult for us to arrange with the soldiers camped next door that when the next time they went out on a working party, they happened to win a few electric light bulbs from somewhere, mm-hmm. and we would get the electric light bulbs back again. Then another time the Japanese had removed the wiring which wired up the electric system altogether. But we then discovered that the barbed wire surrounding the camp was double-stranded. There was one strand which had the bombs on it and another strand which was a plain wire. And it wasn't too difficult a problem to unwind the strand of the plain wire, leaving the barbs in place, and use the plain wire to convey the electricity for the electric light bulbs. And this is the sort of way we're able to circumvent the difficulties put on us by the Japs.
You're talking about incarceration in the camp. Were there any reliefs from this incarceration by way of contact with the outside world there is outside the camp?
Almost none at all. At various times we were told that there would be neutral representatives coming to inspect the camp and so on, but in point of fact they never appeared. And there was a time also when we were told we could send postcards to our relatives, which happened on two or three occasions, and there were a few odd occasions when letters and postcards were received, but these were all right away towards the end of 1944 or 45, and it took a very, very long time for any of these communications to get through.
Were there any other sources of information open to you?
In the early days, the Japanese took over the local Chinese newspaper and published it in Chinese and in Malay. And for a long time, we were able to get a hold of this newspaper. It purported to show the remarkable achievements of the Japanese military and navy, and, of course, of the successes that the Germans were having against the Russians. But when it became obvious that from in one newspaper they would say that the British are about to be driven entirely out of Egypt, and then a week later you would find any thing saying, if the British are so silly as to think that they can invade Tunisia, they've got another thing coming. And then after a month or so, if the Allies are so stupid as to feel that they can invade Sardinia, it will be very unfortunate for them. So we were able, by reading between the lines, to work out that the Allies were advancing and the Axis powers were advancing backwards. And, of course, there was also a clandestine radio which the soldiers had in their camp and which they were very well informed about the up-to-date news from the BBC.
How was the news that they would get through the radio disseminated throughout the camp?
Well, this was the difficulty, because there used to be a representative of the soldiers would meet one or two selected people from the civilians' camp and tell them verbally what the news was. And then we had these two or three individuals who had phenomenal memories, and they would go from hut to hut and relate in the fashion of an old-fashioned storyteller the latest BBC news. And everybody was filled with admiration for their feats of memory, particularly in Russian place names and so on.
It's kind of the principle of the town crier, except the town whisperer, perhaps.
That's right, yes. Very much like that.
Did you... You've mentioned you got outside of the camp from time to time. Did that give you any contact with the local communities or with the other camps in the Kuching complex?
No, outside the camp in the sense that I was using would simply mean going outside the barbed wire of our particular compound into the vegetable gardens outside, which were again still within the perimeter of the camp as a whole. So no, we would have no contact at all with the local civilians, although the soldiers who went on working parties in the towns undoubtedly did have the possibility of contact with civilians. But after the unfortunate events that I mentioned earlier, this became less and less feasible, and the soldiers were less and less inclined to approach the civilians, and the civilians outside less and less inclined to have anything to do with them.
Mm-hmm. Right. At what stage did you begin to anticipate the prospect of liberation?
I can't tell you the exact date, but there certainly came a time when Allied planes appeared overhead. Prior to that, the Japanese had suddenly become very concerned at the possibility of air raids and had required us to dig slit trenches in which to go in the event of an air raid, although I rather suspect that these slit trenches were in fact intended to be our graves. Had there been an Allied landing anywhere near Kuching, and this indeed is what the Allies themselves had thought, because on the first occasion that a plane came over, they could see various people running about in the camp area. And the next occasion, there had been prior warning from the Japs, and everybody had got into these slip trenches, so that, so far as the Allied planes were concerned, they saw nobody at all. And they feared that the worst had happened, that everybody had in fact been killed, which was quite very much on the cards. So the first intimation we had of anything going right for us was the appearance of these Allied planes. And I can remember particularly, I think they were called P-38s. They were double-bodied American planes which followed each other in a seesawing, swinging fashion, which was very interesting to see from the ground. And a few bombs were undoubtedly dropped on Japanese targets in the Kuching area, but there was very, very little bombing at all. And I think by that time the Allies had undoubtedly reached Labuan, and we're establishing a base there. And then, of course, we were, the Japanese, their communications had been so terribly badly disrupted by that time that I think they were almost completely out of touch with their own headquarters. And any planes that they had on the airfield had either been shot up or destroyed by Allied bombing and so on. And so when we heard over our radio of the dropping of the atom bomb in August 1945, I rather think we knew about it before the Japs themselves did, the local Japs anyway. And in fact, they didn't accept anything approaching a surrender until almost a month, the 15th of August, if I remember, was the date of the Hiroshima bomb. And we, in fact, were not liberated until nearly a month after that, although prior to actual liberation, the Allied planes had came over and were dropping food supplies and so on by parachute onto the camp.
How was the ascendancy of the evident ascendancy of the Allies reflected, if at all, in the way the Japanese treated you? Did the treatment change?
It didn't change very much. A number of the guards realized that the writing was on the wall, and those who had reason to think that they had behaved to us in a respectful and reasonable manner were asking for testimonials that they might use in the future. And the ones who had been particularly unpleasant became very much noticeably less unpleasant. And I suppose the general attitude of the commandant became more and more correct as time went on. Although little did we note that his hometown was a place called Hiroshima, which we'd never previously heard of before. And he had every reason to suppose that his entire family had been wiped out, and they probably were. But I think their conduct was, shall I say, correct in every sort of sense. And in fact, I'm pretty reasonably sure that when the Allies in fact did appear, they landed with about a platoon of soldiers, or maybe two, and a couple of jeeps. And they loaded a dozen soldiers into a jeep and drove from one end of the town to the other, got out of the jeep, paraded up and down, jumped into the jeep and drove to the other end of the town. In other words, making one platoon appear to be about the size of a company. And by moving around sufficiently rapidly, gave the impression of being in very much superior force than what in fact was the case. Mm.
Do you have any recollection? You must have a recollection of the arrival of the... It was Americans who...
No, they were Australians who arrived. Mm-hmm. It was the 9th Australian Division, and one of the most remarkable features of it was Brigadier Eastick, if I remember his name rightly. He was a chap who I should think was about 25 stone in weight and as near round as he was tall. And of course, to us who were very skinny, skippy looking individuals, to see somebody as fat and rotund as this was almost unbelievable. And, another rather sad thing was that one of the first things they dropped from the air, very thoughtful of them, was bread and butter in the shape of loaves of bread and hunks of half pounds of butter, which was something, of course, we hadn't seen for many years. And a number of the children who, on being given a loaf, ran to their mother and said, "Mummy, please peel this for me." They had been taught how to peel bananas and fruit like that. They had never seen a loaf of bread in their lives that they could remember, and they felt that this was something that had to be peeled before it could be eaten. It's rather sad, really.
Was there in any way any danger of your liberators sort of killing you with kindness a bit?
I don't think so. They were fairly well. I don't think they were inclined to kill us with kindness. They had all been told that people who had been rather starved and not eating very much should be very careful what they ate in the future. And I think that probably applied to anybody who had dysentery or whose bowels were upset in some way. But speaking for myself, I was exceptionally greedy, and on liberation, the medical people said, "Look, you know the hospital, you know the staff here. Do you think you could gather them up together again and get things going once more?" So I said, "Well, I'd be delighted to do what I could." So they said, "Well, come and join our mess and live with us in the hospital." So I joined their mess, and I ate every meal that the Australians provided for themselves, and these were no mean meals. In the interval, I ate a tin of meat and veg ration in every interval between meals, and I also ate every day at least one pound tin of malt, which they had. I don't know what this was for, possibly for brewing beer or something like that, but they had the tins of sugary malt, and it was delicious stuff. And so I ate about five times as much in all, and suffered no ill effects at all.
Interesting, because I guess you were doing something you'd hardly have recommended for others.
Well, it didn't seem to do me any harm. As long as it didn't upset me, I didn't see how it could upset anybody else. Well, I think those people who were, as I say, the people who were suffering from dysentery probably ought to be rather careful what they ate. But the others, as far as I know, came to no harm at all from eating enormous meals as often and frequently as they could.
Right, finally, what arrangements were made after liberation for your repatriation? How was that organised, carried out?
Well, the medical staff in the hospital said, since you have been good enough to wait on here for a while, we will see to it that you don't get home any later than you would have got home otherwise. And so they organised for me to go from Sarawak to Singapore by air, and from Singapore I stayed in the hospital there with some friends of mine again, and once again they organised for me to fly from Singapore to Colombo, and in Colombo I met with the ship that I would have gone on had I gone home by sea anyway. And so I reached Southampton round about the end of September, beginning of October 1945.
That's how you got back. But
that's how I got back.
How was the repatriation of the internees as a whole
organised? Well, the repatriation was organised that the nearest Australian base was the island of Labuan, and as many people as could be taken were taken to Labuan. And from there, the arrangement was they thought that we should be in such a very bad state that we needed to virtually be hospitalised in Australia. And they had prepared a large camp in the Atherton Tableland in Australia, which in fact I think was hardly used at all. And those people who wanted to go to Australia, or who were Australian, went to Australia. And those who didn't want to go to Australia were put on a ship which eventually went via India and Ceylon back to England.
Good.